Application for calendar 9881, James Capara versus Lauren Chavez.
Good morning. I'm John Lever from Shrimp Hall, and I'm proud to be before you today, representing my client, the appellant, James Capara. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my allotted time for rebuttal comments and not for much time. Let me go right to the point, members of the court. With this case, this court has the opportunity to adopt the sound principle that repeated misconduct is more representative of individual citizens' wrongdoing. For the protection of all motorists on the roads of Ohio, this court should take a logical and reasonable next step from case versus Nunes and provide the proper remedy for a situation such as this to bring to an end those motorists who choose to repeat enough drink and drive. The evidence of this case cried out for this type of remedy. The collision with James Capara, despite the appellee's constant denial throughout the course of the trial, marked the first in less than a 3-year period where the appellee had been involved in driving incidents involving drink.
If that were, and that was in evidence, counsel, three times, that this was the third time, I guess that leads me to question why you would then seek to include the later events in light of the questionable evidentiary premise for including subsequent events. I mean, if the jury had all three, I know that's your argument for why this is harmless error, too, but why would you go down that and get the later event?
Evidence,
most
evidence
from
the
your response then somewhat plays into the argument of your opponent that this was very prejudicial in light of what you just said, that there really wasn't, you weren't able to prove three events. You know, there was, like you say, circumstantial, but you couldn't really show it was a second. It was 2 years hence. You really didn't have much evidence of the drunkenness or the driving drunk in the exact accident. So does that not suggest that it can't be harmless error, if it's error at all?
I think the issue is error at all. That is, whether it's harmless error or not, it's very important. The reason for that is because the appellee in this case wasn't in the answer, thereby concealing any effort.
The fleeing support punitive damages? I mean, we have cases that say drunk driving supports punitive damages in an accident, but do we have cases that say that the fleeing on its own would support it?
There's not enough policy.
Okay.
There's an unreported case that supported it in reparation. But fleeing the scene of an accident, you know yourself that you have an interest in your property damage. When you have reason to suspect that other persons I believe that evidence to be
But we haven't, we just haven't said that yet. That that fleeing would support it with independent of the drunk driving.
The court is not that it's corrupt, but there is a court that has the need, the type of cooperative conduct in the face of other circumstances, which is more evidence than race and support. So that's the issue of the harmless error. In this case, the court of appeals incorrectly found that there was no other evidence directed to the intoxication that night. Completely overlooked the eyewitness testimony of the jury card. But more importantly, if the court of appeals is in fact correct that there was no other evidence of intoxication that night, why did it remain the case to trial for a full trial of merit, including punitive damages? Why wouldn't the punitive damages go out of it?
Let's go through the Court of Appeals opinion for just a moment, because that was concerning me when I looked at the other part of the record that seemed to indicate there was drinking. Now, we're talking about, let's talk about three things. First of all, whether there was alcohol at the time of this accident, whether there was a prior history of alcohol and driving, and subsequent acts after the day of the accident. The Court of Appeals said, in the case before us, there is no direct evidence that Shibu was intoxicated at the time of the accident. Is that true?
That's not correct, Your Honor.
The security guard, there's an eyewitness there who said that the, I think he said he staggered, but that he saw his demeanor as being one that of an intoxicated person, didn't he?
The security guard observed the whole accident. The after the accident, wasn't being watched. There were four of them living on the long side of the road with my car. He then pulled away from that accident, pulled over a 2,000 watt mercury vapor light on the barren company, the within 5 or 6 feet of a security guard from the Cavalier never saw him. He said, out of his car, put a hand on top of the vehicle to stable him, gave him back to the community accident where the security of the car zoomed to my client's car with my client in it. Looked around, fell back in his car, slammed the door, slammed on the accelerator, ripped over the curb, and flew away. That is the evidence which the security guard, who is very well reliable, by the way, very well challenged, was able to offer the correct label to the man that, in fact, he believed that the driver of that car was in
that evidence. That evidence was admitted.
That evidence was admitted.
Okay, then the Court of Appeals goes on to say that you attempted to prove the intoxication by way of Shively's driving record, past and future. That is also true, is it not?
I attempted to prove his conduct with the past and future driving record. Because, and I think the history shows that once you have evidence that warrants a determination
what is the evidence of the prior driving record? Because they don't contest that that's admissible.
The evidence of the prior driving record involves an arrest in July of 1990 for DUI. That was reduced to reckless operation. The license was suspended 30 days upon his initial appearance because this was, according to the conviction record, its second.
Okay, I understand that now. What is your best argument that subsequent acts after the date of the accident, alcohol related, are admissible? Moskowitz?
Moskowitz is a case which provides the court with the authority to analyze this from the standpoint that malicious conduct need not occur at the time of a potential harm. Otherwise, I submit to you that Moskowitz really does not apply here because the subsequent acts in this case did not, were not enough of trying to steal from
That's why I wondered why it was cited, because, you know, I wrote Moskowitz, and I didn't have any intention to show subsequent acts as being, obviously, when the doctor changed the records to conceal what he had done, that could have been contemporaneously with the action, and maybe subsequent to it, but I had no idea we were going to see it cited for the proposition that it's all right to introduce subsequent acts. Do you have any other thing to rely on that gives us a right, or we should look at the subsequent acts alcohol-related?
There's a
say that that's the pillars upon which the Court of Appeals relied to reverse this case?
In this case, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals was swayed by the concern, and I think a prominent concern, of proving or characterizing the evidence as character evidence, trying to show a state of mind in the past, even subsequent acts to show a state of mind prior to state of mind. And that is not the purpose here. The court has said since 1959 that it is rarely possible from actual malice, otherwise than by conduct and the surrounding circumstances. One who has committed an action would scarcely admit that he or she was malicious about it. And so necessarily, malice can be inferred from the conduct.
The malice here is drunk driving. You know, doesn't dislike, you know, this man drove drunk and harmed your client. Now, don't you want to show with those later drunk driving incidents that this is a fellow who has a drinking problem? Isn't that his character? Isn't that exactly what 404 seeks to keep out of evidence? But you still get back into the problem you admit the Court of Appeals had, which is using later drunk driving incidents, say the person, you know, swore off. You know, but they could have before the accident. I mean, you can say all this about stuff that happened before the accident, but it's tough. That's what the Court of Appeals was hung up on. How can we say that the state of mind of this fellow, the malice that it took to get in the car, is shown by his later continuation? In your point, it's continued behavior, and it's the same old thing. Here's a guy who always does this.
The problem is, in my opinion, that when you always have to understand the evidence of drinking and driving on that,
okay,
this is the aggravating circumstance which should let a jury separate the evidence for the jury's point of view to a person who is the one time and is drinking and driving versus someone who does it 6 or 7 times during the course of which a single action where he injured someone.
Yeah. But you still run up against then Rule 403. And the problem with if you're trying to prove the drunkenness that night through this later drinking, that's so prejudicial that, you know, to prove, when you're trying to prove he was drunk that night and you say, well, look, there's two other DUIs later, that the Court of Appeals said, boy, you know, that you're proving the drunken driving that night through the later, which is a 404 I mean, a 403 problem, too. But it's in there, even though maybe that it had a dual purpose. If it's offending for its one purpose, aren't we still in a problem with that?
Under 404B, that then comes in the state line, and that's the whole purpose of the standard. But more importantly, it worked with it. The jury heard this evidence, and by their verdict, there was no evidence by the verdict alone that there was any evidence that they were questioned by the jury. They're concerned with the verdict. Why
should we disregard this? That's speculative. I mean, everybody might say, boy, that seems right to me, too. But it is speculation.
But it goes into the model there. Where is the question? The inference cannot cry out that the jury wasn't pleasant anymore. And the court of appeal must have an injury. Needs to make a determination.
Was the verdict against, is the judgment against, the is it joint and several against the individual and the company, or how is that, how did that come out?
The judgment was against both the company and the individual. At the court of appeals level, we were the appellant, and we raised all kinds of error. The court of appeals, the first assignment of error was based on plain error. state of mind that has existed on prior dates of such importance that it must have affected the verdict. And the court appealed to the 8th District unanimously found that indeed it did plain error. There's no question about that. Mr. Shively's subsequent bad driving record, which included two driving under the influence of alcohol, one reckless operation, and a failure to yield to the lengthy license suspension, all of which occurred in a number of years following this accident in October 1992. No question that that was extremely prejudicial to both Warren Shively and his family gentleman, Shively Chemical Company. It had no probative value for the issue, the specific issue, which was the state of mind of both Warren Shively and Shively Chemical Company on October 13th of 1992. What was their state of mind on that day? It had no probative value for that. What it did, in fact, put it in a possible human burden on Warren Shively and Shively Chemical Company, that he was required, his company was required to know what the future would hold. And based upon that knowledge, the future event somehow affected his conduct on October 13th of 1992, a prior point in time. Many of the danger of allowing him prior or subsequent bad acts to the state of mind on a prior occasion, in addition to the problem evidence, the evidence rule and character is if you're opening up Pandora's box, you're going to have due process and equal protection problems for citizens of the state of Ohio in future cases. And what I mean by that is, in auto accident cases where this comes up again, it does come up over and over again, you're going to have situations where citizens of this state who are at fault drivers are going to be treated differently depending on how fast the case gets put in trial, gets filed and put into trial. There are situations where a case can be tried within a year of the accident. There are other situations where it's 4 or 5 years after the accident before a case gets tried. And in the first case, only have a situation where a citizen is treated such that the jury only looked at 1 year of post-accident driving. In the second situation, you have a citizen being treated differently and the jury considering up to 4 or 5 years of post-accident driving.
Counsel, are you saying that without the subsequent conviction that the jury had no evidence with which to award punitive damages?
I think the evidence that would go to punitive damages was major at best and related to questionable circumstantial evidence, which is the testimony of the jury.
Meager at best?
At best.
Isn't leaving the scene of the accident more injurious to your client than driving under the influence of alcohol? Doesn't leaving the scene of the accident show more indifference and more evidence to show that the jury should consider punitive damages than any drinking he may have done?
That's true. Testimony of Warren Shively was he got out of the car, looked back, and didn't see any car at the intersection of 36th Street Newport. After midnight, looked back and heard. So his own testimony was he looked back, didn't see the other vehicle, didn't know if it was still there, but had left the scene. I believe he said he assumed it had left the
scene. Was he asked what he thought he hit? I mean, since nothing was in his view when he looked, was there a question in his mind as to what he hit?
I don't believe there was a question in his mind.
Did he know?
What happened if it was an intersection accident?
Oh, he knew he hit another car?
With another vehicle, yeah.
I see. But his testimony is that car left the scene also?
His question was his testimony. He looked back at the intersection, didn't see the other vehicle in the intersection, and assumed it was.
But he didn't stay and investigate to where that other car may be.
No, he didn't.
I'm just saying, I think without the subsequent conviction evidence, that there is evidence to allow the jury to award punitive damages if they disbelieve his testimony as to what you just told us. So that the subsequent convictions could be harmless error.
Sweeney's asking you if fleeing itself can support it. Has fleeing, I asked counsel for the other side, if we have held that fleeing, that the state of mind that one flees a scene of an accident, and I suppose we'd have to add the factor where it's suspected that someone's injured, does that support punitive?
I don't believe in and of itself it does. I'm not sure that the evidence is that clear, but
well, let's say he did. I mean, that's the point. A jury could say he should have known somebody was there, and why didn't he see? Because he was drunk. You know, these are all reasonable.
That's the reason. In terms of there are other reasons.
I know, but we're not talking about. We're just talking a jury could have. We're talking a legal question here. Has fleeing been held to support an award of punitive damages in a negligence action for a motor vehicle accident? There's an appellate case, apparently.
I would take the position that in and of itself it does not.
Why?
And the reason is because...
Well, because we're only talking about in and of itself,
right,
okay?
Right, because the decision that occurs after the accident.
Okay.
It doesn't go to show the state of mind prior to the accident to prove the issue of the state of mind.
And the claim is that the negligence claim is about the accident.
Yeah.
But you can have an inference that he fled the scene because he was drunk.
That is one inference that can be drawn. But other inferences can be drawn, such as that nobody was there. The accident had occurred. There was nobody other vehicle that left the scene. And he wanted to go home.
But actually, we have fleeing the scene of the accident and the eyewitness testimony about his demeanor and his conduct of walking and sliding and so forth. We have two things: fleeing the scene of the accident and someone there who would corroborate that drinking was more likely than not. Correct?
Correct, Bob. Mm-hmm. The testimony of the security guard was that he observed Mr. Scheifele at about 30 feet away from the shoulders up for a few seconds. Not to be someone staggering around the car.
But that's your job, or the trial counsel's job, to convince them that...
So that's what he said.
But that's not direct evidence of drunkenness. It's circumstantial evidence.
That's correct.
Right.
The reason this testimony is objectionable, if it is objectionable, it goes to the punitive damages issue, doesn't it?
Oh,
no. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I think the real serious danger of this evidence is that you are putting an impossible burden on anybody. You have to know what the future holds.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that. But it goes to the punitive damages issue.
It wouldn't go to the
compensatory damages issue. Why would the Court of Appeals then have reversed the whole case? And if we look at it from your point of view, wouldn't it best we still remand this back to trial for only for punitive damages? Because the compensatory damages certainly are not aligned, and you admitted negligence. Why should that be reversed on the subsequent acts evidence?
My only response to that can be that it was reversed on plain error, and the nature of plain error is such that the character of public confidence in the judicial system is undercut. And that's the argument that I'm making to you, that it's so overwhelming that it affects the entire case.
But that wouldn't affect his admission of negligence,
no, it would not.
This is a clear liability, broken leg, and $28,000. You probably settled hundreds of cases of broken legs and clear liabilities for more money than that, haven't you? $28,000 for a broken leg? I believe you.
At least not hundreds.
$28,000 for a broken leg with maybe $8,000 or $10,000 in medicals and lost wages, that's out of order? For a settlement, let alone a jury verdict?
Well, you know, we're talking about the effect of such a prejudicial error that has gone to the level of the plan.
No, I just want to know if you really meant that it prejudiced the compensatory damages as well. I don't see how it could.
I believe that it did. I believe the jury, in hearing all this information about Mr. Shadow's substance and bad driving, how can they keep that clear in their head in terms of determining compensatory damages? I think that
it was only offered for punitive damage sake, was it not? It was only offered to show punitive damages?
It was offered to show the state of mind on balance for Mark Shackley and his family's death
of the Shadow Council. For punitive damages purposes only?
Yes, that's right.
What were the
recommend that maybe future knee replacements cost $10,000.
What were the amount of the defense price?
We don't recall. Yeah. I think they were in the nature of $10,000 to $15,000, including the future.
So, $5,000
for life. That's my answer.
Thank you. So, Ivor, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
This court has previously said in involving a similar issue of subsequent evidence in a McFarland case that there is a contention by some that the introduction of such evidence could be highly prejudicial to the defendant. While this contention may have some validity, an equally plausible assertion can be made on behalf of an injury claimant that such evidence is excluded. It is equally prejudicial. Without question, all evidence forms a part of an injury is to some extent prejudicial. That is the very essence of evidence in our adversary statutory system, let the jury decide. I respectfully request that this court refer to the findings of the court of appeal.
And I'll go over to your recommendation.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.